Xi Jinping does what's right for China and what he was going to do anyway, then it looks like he's backing down in the face of a foreign enemy. So Trump has shot himself and the Chinese in the foot.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. Welcome back. My guest this episode is Bill Overholt, who over the course of the last half century has emerged as one of the most astute Asia watchers out there. I first met Bill in 1991 as a cub reporter with the Asian Wall Street Journal in Hong Kong. Bill was a rare breed of investment banker, a thinker, someone with an uncanny ability to draw on history, policy, and economic trends to forecast the future. Today, he's better known as Professor Overholt, a senior research fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also served as director of the RAND Corporation's Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. His professional career is an amalgamation of banking, policy, and academia that's given birth to 8 books. But it was the release of his most recent book, China's Crisis of Success, that led me to reconnect with the professor after more than 20 years. I started our conversation by asking him to think back. Did he have any idea back in the 1980s that China would emerge as the economic superpower that it is today?
I was writing very early that Deng Xiaoping would, in his economic reforms, would make China a superpower eventually, and that Gorbachev had the wrong end of the stick and would destroy the Soviet Union. And that argument came from my study of South Korea and Taiwan and understanding of what works and what doesn't. What doesn't was the American ideology of putting politics first and focusing on democratization rather than feeding people.
Is that a unique perspective just by virtue of being in Hong Kong at the time, really right on the, you know, on the brink or looking across to see what's going on? You feel it day in, day out in a way that perhaps those living in the U.S. and elsewhere didn't.
It really came from much earlier. I worked for the Hudson Institute. My boss was Herman Kahn, the great nuclear strategist and futurologist. And February of 73, they had a conference in Seoul. And I was asked to write a paper about the political economy of Korea. And I wrote this sort of standard American view that the human rights problems and lack of democracy would mean political instability and short-circuit economic growth. And Herman said, "Bill, I'm going to take you to South Korea and rub your nose in it." and I got there, and my original standard ideological views are reflected in the book that came out called Korean Futures. But I looked around and studied the history and found that I was dead wrong. I don't like to be wrong. So
was that the first and only time?
There have been a few. So I went back and back and came to the view that the Asian miracles succeed by fixing agriculture and land distribution first, and then light industry, and then heavy industry, and then domestic politics, and then international affairs. And so when I was looking at China and the Soviet Union, I said, that's what Deng Xiaoping is doing. He's just following the Korea-Taiwan model. I said, look at Gorbachev. He's doing international politics first and domestic politics second, and heavy industry third, and light industry fourth, and agriculture never. And that's backwards. And that's what we teach countries to do. It doesn't work.
Is there an example of a country that did pursue economic reforms first and failed or faltered? Or is this a standard approach that has been applied successfully throughout Southeast Asia or Asia and maybe even Latin America?
Well, I don't think there are any countries who followed the right economic approach and have failed. I think there are Latin American countries that pursued protectionist policies that they thought would lead to economic growth, and they failed because their policies were wrong. But I think the big failures are really the countries that do it our way because conditions, social conditions, are different in very poor countries. And my lead example of that is the country that for a long time I knew best, the Philippines. And in the Philippines, we spent half a century creating the right institutions, a great legal system and fair elections and a free press. And when they became independent, they were the most advanced country in the third world. And it wasn't clear whether Japan or the Philippines was going to be the richest economy in Asia.
But it didn't last.
And it didn't last because in a country of landlords and peasants, and I've published an article through Brookings about this last year. In a country of landlords and very poor peasants, when you hold an election, the landlords get together and they win. And they say,
by strong-arming their constituents, strong-arming the peasants?
Well, the peasants just don't have any idea how to get organized. And they can't donate to a campaign. They can't organize for themselves. So their interests are ignored. And so in the Philippines or India or Thailand, when it was democratic, the rich people, they have wonderful colleges, universities, highly subsidized, and the poor people have a hard time getting literate. And the leading medical institutions in India or the Philippines are wonderful, but things like the rates of maternal death, the rates of infant death, the rates of horrible diseases like tuberculosis are half a dozen times higher in a place like India than they are in China or Korea or Taiwan, where some nasty dictator first distributed the land and gave everybody a chance, and then gave everybody a basic education, and then built the infrastructure that attracts light industry, and so everybody gets a job, and then make sure everybody gets housing. People forget. It's never mentioned that Chinese home ownership is the highest in the world at 85%. And then they all have a great property inflation, whether it's Japan or Korea or Taiwan or China. And as a result, since everybody has a home, everybody ends up with substantial assets. And it works. Mm-hmm. But then when they've had success and they've got a middle class society, then things get too complicated to run as a dictatorship, either in the economics or the politics.
Why after all these repeated successes, year after year, decade after decade, economics first, politics later, do U.S. policymakers continue to not get it? Why does ideology continue to prevail when it comes to persuading or cajoling developing markets to go the path of the American, you know, process? What gets in the way?
Well, democratic ideology is what holds our country together. And high-ranking Chinese officials come to the United States. They look around and hear all these different kinds of Europeans and African-Americans and Chinese and Korean and Indian-Americans. And they say to me, what holds your country together? Other countries are held together by ethnic ties. And I say it's democracy. And this ideology is so central to everything we believe that we just assume that it works everywhere.
This is Inside Asia, and you're listening to my conversation with Harvard's Bill Overholt, author of China's Crisis of Success. More in a moment. I'm Steve Stein, and I'm speaking with Bill Overholt, Senior Research Fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. In his most recent book, Bill argues that the so-called miracle economies of Asia, that's Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore, arise as a result of certain specific conditions. I start the second part of our conversation by asking him to elaborate on the ingredients behind Asia's economic miracle mix.
The first thing is they're scared witless. It's Japan after World War II. It's South Korea after the Korean War. It's Taiwan after losing the Chinese Civil War. It's Singapore after the horrific breakup with Malaysia. And everybody's just terrified that the whole society is going to collapse and their kids are going to starve. And it means that leaders take very unusual risks, imposing changes on the population that they normally never try. And the populations accept that because they're so scared.
So they feel that fear. It pervades, and therefore leadership is an easier process because you've got people believing and thinking the same way.
Yeah. And, you know, if the leaders get it wrong, like Mao Zedong, then it's a catastrophe. But if they get it right and follow this pattern of what the Chinese call reform and opening, which, again, they learned from South Korea and Taiwan and a little bit from Japan and Singapore, then they just take off like a rocket. The other thing is it only works in countries where there's a certain degree of cohesion. When the Koreans, South Koreans found themselves with a military dictator, Syngman Rhee, who wasn't hacking it, losing ground in North Korea, they were able to get together and get rid of him. And then when there was a democratically elected president, Jong Un, who wasn't hacking it, they got together and got rid of him. And finally, when I got Park Chung-hee, who saved the place, Laos can't do that. It doesn't have the cohesion. The Philippines didn't have the fear.
Yeah, or the ability to switch out leaders through a democratic process. You're saying that the problem here is that if you have a strong man who's in power, who's annihilated his opposition, and things start to go off the rails, there's no recourse.
Right. And with Mao created a mess, but the Chinese society had that degree of cohesion to come together and coalesce around a new approach.
You know, you say in the opening of your book, something to the effect of continued success requires reinvention of its economy and its politics. I guess that's true with any nation, including the U.S., and are you suggesting that China is now at that inflection point, that they've run the gauntlet, succeeded to the degree that they're able, given the conditions, but now they're in for a whole different level? And are you questioning or are you challenging the government's ability to make the leap?
Absolutely. They are where Taiwan and South Korea were at the end of the 70s and early 80s. You know, for instance, in Korea, Park Chung-hee was running the whole economy out of Blue House. Every major company was told how much to produce, how much to export. The amount of their loans were decided by the presidential secretary. The interest rate on the loans was decided by the presidential secretary. Mm. And it just wasn't working anymore. Mm. And the same on the politics. They weren't a nation of landlords, peasants, road builders, and cheap socks makers anymore. They had to change their economics and they had to change their politics.
But wasn't the politics first in that case? Wasn't it changing the leadership and then, you know, new policies followed? Wasn't that the case?
That was. It was kind of a seesaw that Park Chung-hee was assassinated and they tried democracy and some new economic policies, and dictatorship came back, and it kind of wobbled for about 9 years. In Taiwan, it was much smoother. Jiang Zemin was a really nasty Leninist, brutal security chief, but he was close to the society and he understood the changes. So they had a smoother transition. It was very gradual, both economically and politically. Gradual meaning a decade. So China's at that point.
Mm. Do you believe Xi Jinping is out of touch with his populace? Do you think he understands how these changes have impacted the man on the ground?
Well, on the economic side, they're like Taiwan, like the Tianjin Guo. They've got a brilliant economic plan. They recognize the problem. They've said we have to move to market allocation of resources. You know, it's too complicated. You can't run it out of an institution in Beijing. So you give it to the market, which makes the decisions automatic and makes them more efficiently. And so they published China 2030 with the World Bank before Xi Jinping came in. Then they refined it in what they call the third plenum. It's absolutely brilliant. But the politics aren't working, even to implement the economic plan.
you think it's going to, the infrastructure, the political infrastructure isn't in place to see through the plan as envisioned.
Right. They face these gigantic interest groups and provinces going in their own way, and it scares them, so they centralize the politics. And the tool for centralizing is the anti-corruption campaign.
Right.
But the anti-corruption campaign scares the bejesus out of everybody. Mm. So they're afraid to vigorously implement reforms.
So it feeds on itself to the point where inaction is action.
And then I say, well, we're gonna marketize the state enterprises on the economic side, but we're going to strengthen the party committee's control strategy inside every enterprise. We're going to have the rule of law, but we're going to strengthen the party commission that actually makes the verdicts.
And that appears to be where they are now. Well, Bill, what can or should be done practically? What could be done practically to make adjustments to allow for this transition?
Well, they're going to have to come up with a way, like a market, where these decisions make themselves. And that's the virtue of a system of elections and rule of law. That has become an ideological problem since they've got this confrontation with the U.S., and the U.S. has not been helpful there. The U.S. is has sort of welcomed China economically, but militarily and ideologically, it's just a constant beaming of how bad the Chinese are.
To what degree is the, in a U.S.-China all-out trade war, if we're headed that direction, who has the most to lose? And to what degree will that impede Xi Jinping's ability to reform the way he needs to?
Both sides will lose terribly if this continues to escalate. What it does, Trump's strategy makes it politically very, very difficult to do liberalizing reforms that he was planning to do. He was fighting hard within China, and they were already talking about liberalizing foreign access to the services economy and working on some of the intellectual property problems. But now Trump has made that a nationalistic issue. If Xi Jinping backs down to Trump, if Xi Jinping does what's right for China and what he was going to do anyway, then it looks like he's backing down in the face of a foreign enemy.
Right.
So Trump has shot himself and the Chinese in the foot.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Harvard's Bill Overholt, Senior Research Fellow at the Kennedy School of Government and author most recently of the book China's Crisis of Success. As listeners know, we end each show with an Asia Insider Minute, where I try to point out some of the clear takeaways from the conversation you've just heard and offer a few thoughts of my own. There are a number of things that jump out when we consider the perspective offered by Professor Overholt, the first of which is a continual theme on this program, that to function effectively in Asia, you need to take Asia on its own terms. Westerners in general, and Americans in particular, have a hard time letting go of the notion that democratic values always serve as a precursor to economic liberalization. To be fair, by reinstituting democratic institutions in Europe post-World War II, economies did flourish. So maybe it's understandable that Western economies fixated on the idea that the same model would work elsewhere in the world. Asia tells us a different story. Instead of political liberalization, the miracle economies of this region start by answering fundamental and pressing economic questions. It's only after you put food in the mouths of your people that you can start worrying about the electoral process. These are countries where cohesion is born out of crisis. That tends to generate a very different set of priorities than those encountered by America's founding fathers. But as Bill Overholt sees it, there's a catch. Eventually, he argues, political liberalization must have its day. Without it, the miracle economies cannot make the leap from manufacturing-driven and export-led to something greater. Look to the examples of the so-called four Asian tigers, that's Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea, says Bill, and you'll see the inevitable shift from top-down command economy to bottom-up market innovation. Suppress a population's ability to explore freedom of expression, political dissent, and untethered enterprise, and you squelch the levers that hold the promise of economic reinvention. Which brings us to China. Are we seeing the move toward political liberalization that history suggests is waiting in the wings? We are not. Instead, we see recentralization and a cult of personality that threatens to stifle economic growth at the precise moment when China needs a surge of market reinvention. Curiously enough, China knows that. The promulgation of far-sighted policies like Made in China 2025 and the Belt and Road Initiative are evidence of China's need and desire to push beyond its current boundaries. In many ways, it feels like a throwback to the early 1960s, when Chen Yun, one of China's great architects, introduced the caged bird analogy, where the bird represented the free market and the cage, China's centrally planned economy. While such an approach might have worked in lifting China from a poverty-stricken agrarian economy to a global manufacturing phenom, the very idea of control in the information age feels less like a plan and more like an oxymoron. So here's the big unanswered question. If Asia's four dragons are evidence that political liberalization can usher in a new level of economic expansion, must China follow suit? Or will the Middle Kingdom prove to the world that there is yet a third way, one that is uniquely Chinese and defiantly controlling? Stay tuned. This story is still in the making. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.